You're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
But this is what I'm calling Media Meltdown, where I get people from the Media Studies Department here on Otago campus to come on and break down some different media and critical theory concepts for you all, repackaging them in a way that I think is digestible, because I think they're very important and I think everybody should know them in our very media-orientated age. This week, I'm excited to be joined by Rosemary Overell. How you doing?
Good, thanks. It's such a pleasure to be here, and so happy that one of our alumni is now in the driving seat for the breakfast show, Lily.
Yeah. When I go into Olivier's lectures, I always tell people, I'm like, you can get a job. They do exist in media, mm-hmm. and broadcasting even.
Definitely.
Yeah, and you yourself, you did a show on Radio 1 from 2013 to 2016.
Correct, yes. Yeah. So I did a show called Culture Jamming, which was actually a bit like what you just said. Mm. The idea was I was using critical theory concepts, but kind of breaking them down over, I think it was a two-hour slot on a Sunday, and playing interviews I'd done, pre-records and tracks. So, yeah, I loved it. But as you would know, doing a radio show is actually a lot of mahi. So yeah. I had to give that away. But it's great to be back in the station, yeah.
Yeah. Changed ever so slightly, more black paint, mm-hmm. mainly. Now, you kind of special in a couple different areas. One of your areas, subcultural mm-hmm. studies, and another one is Lacanian media and feminist studies. I'm going to kind of touch on topics in all of these, but first, you have a book coming out, and I want to pitch this, you to pitch it to people on the radio.
Yeah, cool. So I've got a book coming out in December this year. It's a 33 and a third book. So mm-hmm. these are little books which focus on an album of a particular artist. And my one's on Blood Duster's album, Fisting the Dead. So Blood Duster are a Melbourne-based grindcore band. And it's an academic book, so it's published by Bloomsbury Academic, but it's also aimed at a popular or fan audience. So what I get into is the culture of transgression within grindcore music and extreme metal. So that sort of deliberate performance of vulgarity and bad taste. But I also look at how things like cultural policy informed subcultural practice in the early 90s in Melbourne. So that album came out in 1993 when I was a wee ban, listening to Ace of Base and things like that, not metal. But I did some interviews with the guys in the band, and that's formed the book, yeah.
Amazing. And it's up for pre-order at the moment.
Yeah, you can actually buy the e-book potentially. Yeah, it's certainly for pre-order, and it's at a good price point, like around $20. So
great for a book.
Yeah.
That's really great for a book. Yeah. Every book that I buy, I feel, is like $35 these days.
I know. And academic books are crazy. They can go for $90 or something. Gosh. So I'm glad of the price point.
Yeah. Now, kind of around the topic, let's jump into talking about punk and metal and these underground subcultures and how it has changed from something very authentic to now something that can be quite performative. Do you want to speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, for sure. And this is something we cover in our papers. So I'll also give a plug for studying with us in media, film
of
and
course.
Comms. But this is a really key idea in subcultural studies, but something your listeners will have probably encountered. So you go from experiencing a scene at a grassroots level. So, for instance, in Dunedin, you know, there's an excellent alternative music scene, metal scene that might be around a particular venue like The Crown. And this seems sort of organic or grassroots, has particular styles, might be fashion, words, or types of musical style. But, you know, there's a line where it might gush up, we say, and become a commodity object, so something you could buy off the rack. So, for instance, I'm going to speak more broadly than Dunedin now. In metal or extreme metal, we might think of how shops like Cotton On and things, you could buy a Cannibal Corpse t-shirt. So they're a death metal band from the States, but the idea would be someone's wearing the band t-shirt as an aesthetic rather than actually listening to the band. So I guess what we'd call that is commodified rebellion. So they're wearing the Cannibal Corpse t-shirt because it looks kind of gross and ugly and freaky, but there's not an actual engagement potentially with the music.
Mm. I think I see this a lot, even just on campus. When I first started out with a student, I remember the fashion back then, and it was quite, and I'm not judging anybody for how they dress, but it was quite a basic sort of fashion. It was a lot of the jeans and just hoodies, and you still kind of see that around. But now when I walk around campus, I'm going, no one dressed this alternative when I was a student. You know, you'd have the people, but overall, broadly, the fashion styles have changed and become so much more alternative. And I've spoken to people who'd be like, it's hard to tell if someone is actually, if they live that life and they have those political beliefs that go along with it, or if it is just an aesthetic that they're drawing on, because once you go online and you self-brand yourself and you connect to these certain aesthetics, it's a lot more about just how you look than actually living the lifestyle, right?
Yeah, correct. I mean, punk's probably a better example because that does have that ingrained political aspect from the start. So we can think back to the 1970s and 80s with bands like Crass or Napalm Death had heavy transgressive music, but also staunchly radical politics. You know, they didn't want to be co-opted by Sony Music or something. You know, they're signed to Relapse and eventually in the end. But yes, so there's a political element, and when it becomes commodified, it potentially loses that. So, I mean, it's not necessarily a new phenomenon, but potentially in the last 10 or so years, it's become more intensified and accelerated because of, you know, digital media. You could easily get a starter pack or guide to how, you know, what are the deep cuts of grindcore or crust punk. You could find an explainer article or something like this. Whereas in earlier times, you probably had to sort of seek that out by subscribing to particular magazines or zines or listening to student radio or something like that. Or even more sort of analog would be kind of the tape trading scene. So that's something I talk about in my book, which is how Australian grindcore, Australia being a long way from the UK and America where grindcore was, and Japan where it was really kicking off, it grew out of tape trading. So men, mostly men, were sending cassettes to Australians, and Australians were sending cassettes back of local bands. And this is how you'd find new music. Whereas today it's all sort of available ready-made in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I agree. I think certainly students are probably at the cutting edge of subcultures in a way. And I agree. I see more of that kind of willingness to wear something a little more transgressive in the last 10 years here than perhaps 5 or so years ago.
Let's call it all about the kind of upcoming revival of emo and indie sleaze along with this, which I guess there is a form of, for someone my age, and I'm 24, there is an element of nostalgia to it. I have older siblings and they kind of lived through it. So I guess it's a nostalgia of when I was young and I would see what they were wearing and listening to and everything. But for a lot of people younger than me, they don't even have that direct connection to it. It's kind of wanting to be a part of something that has been and gone, which I guess is a little bit like, you know, in the 70s, the revival in the 50s culture and kitsch and music, right?
Yeah, really good example. So even we could talk about as postmodern, a nostalgia for something we haven't experienced that we can just consume. So Frederick Jamison wrote about the revival for 50s kind of looks in 1970s and 80s film. When I was growing up in the 90s, there was kind of a 60s revival with the Doors movie. I always say that was a canon moment. So the Jim Morrison look and the Paisley and all this. But certainly now we're seeing this look back to the early aughts, so indie sleaze and emo revival. But it's also a kind of reimagining of these forms as less commercial than they actually were. A lot of those bands were signed to majors and, you know, within the sort of system of capitalism, but reimagining them through like the sharing of old, like that aesthetic now of digital cam, digital cam photos and things like that, kind of presents them as more sort of analog or authentic compared to the sort of slickness of pop music now. But again, it becomes something potentially you could just buy off the shelf, a style. But yeah, I mean, also with emo, I myself had a sort of complex relationship to it. I really liked a lot of emo music, But within the grindcore scene, emo was seen as like completely other, if you will, because it was associated with a kind of feminized form of metal.
Right.
And more broadly, back in the day, it was kind of the boys wearing girl jeans and this kind of, there were even moral panics about emo.
Yeah.
So it seems this revival has repressed a lot of that politics as well. It's more just kind of the poppy tunes and the look, the swept over fringe and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember like when my siblings were growing up and them engaging with those aesthetics and subcultures and it being something to be slightly ashamed of and something that made you weird and other. And now you're right, it's the cool thing and jeans get tighter again.
I'm glad for that because it took a lot to peel my skinny jeans off. And I'm hoping they come back in fashion. Although, look, for years I wore flares and said I'd never wear skinny jeans. But, yeah, I'm looking forward to them coming back in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And with nostalgia, there's always a danger to it, right? Mm-hmm. When we're constantly looking back, and I think it's super prevalent now with social media and how just obsessed with the fantasy of the past that we can get and go, oh, remember. And I think for young people there is an element that times are tough. And mm-hmm. COVID was a complete game changer and you were really reminiscing about something before then. But nostalgia isn't good.
Well, for sure. I mean, a lot of nostalgia can very much lean towards reactionary or right-wing politics yeah. because you're kind of imagining some past that's kind of folded through your fantasy of what that past is. So it's a past where everyone could buy a house or groceries were cheaper. That sounds fairly innocuous, but it might also be a past without Māori people or without migrants or without LGBT people. So there's that tipping point as well. And as I say, those fantasies of the past often remember the sort of, what would we say, halcyon or heavenly aspects rather than potentially the on-the-ground contradictions and grind. So you know, there's lots of memes saying, oh, our baby boomer parents bought their house at 21 or something like this. And sure, for the majority, that's true.
Yeah.
But there were also lots of conflicts and tensions in the 70s and 80s as well that we might forget if we just kind of glorify it.
Mm.
I think we should always be looking forward
yeah.
and progressing rather than kind of falling back into nostalgia. So with pop music or subcultural music, what interests me the most is when perhaps an old style's picked up and they do something new with it. So I think Amanita are doing something different with punk and emo, taking some of that but changing the lyrics and things to be more responsive to issues around today, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I see that with a major top 40 pop music that for the last, I don't even know, maybe 20 years, does it feel like it's just stuck on a loop of 80s, 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 80s? And it's every new major pop artist, they go, we've stalled in pop music. And especially when labels and how music is distributed and made nowadays and those changes, that freshness doesn't exist. I was listening to Justin Timberlake's album the other day and I was like, wow, this is insane production. And he was really doing something different with this album and changing pop music in a way, but then it seems like it just keeps coming back to the same 80s motifs.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, the 80s has lots of catchy hooks and that high production slick value that came in with out of the 70s and into the 80s pop. I guess it still connects. Mm. We still have that sort of very slick production making hits. But I will say, like, and I'm probably out of date and you'd know more cool stuff, but I do think Charlie XCX's Brat was actually kind of a moment where something more interesting was done with pop music. And she, why? Because she added to pop subcultural elements, you know.
Yeah, hyperpop and A.G. Cook and the beginning of that very, what was once a very weird subculture and him taking that into the mainstream now, yeah.
And even like the, you know, she does the album with the remixes and guest artists, like doing stuff like that. That is interesting. And also she kind of, I guess, introduces subcultural elements to a more mainstream audience. And we could go, oh, okay, that means that artist has sold out now because she did a duet with Charlie. But I think that's kind of a limited perspective. So I think there's a lot of interesting things still happening in pop. But if it is sort of routed through the same type of production format, the same kind of Tin Pan Alley lyric writers and things, you do get a kind of dull product. But that also sows the seeds for people to do something interesting at a grassroots level, which, for instance, happens here in Dunedin with the DIY scene.
Yeah, totally. And speaking more to Charlie, she's very much finger on the pulse of cynicism and how young people view their lives, their futures, that everything is so recycled. And we know this, and even someone who doesn't engage with media or critical theory can tell that everything is recycled. And she's speaking to that, and she's going, it's okay to sell out. You know, selling out is a thing that every pop artist does. I'm going to be honest about it. And in a way, giving people a little bit of a release with the honesty.
Exactly. That's such a good point. It gives people kind of an enjoyment, right?
Yeah.
That she is kind of being authentic in her inauthenticity. So the remix she did with Lorde, right? Let's make it up on the remix. I mean, the remix to me is better than the original.
Yeah.
But they actually talk about the industry in the lyrics. Like, we're just two sides of the same coin. You know, one's the alt white woman, Lorde, and Charlie offers a more kind of edgy young girl from Essex vibe.
Yeah.
So I think potentially that kind of ultra cynicism is respected more. Plus, she's also all over multimedia, right? Because nowadays a pop star has to also be savvy with social media. I mean, not her personally, but her crew.
Yeah.
She's made the film. You know, this kind of ability to have a wink and have multiple or even contradictory narratives going on between the album, the social media presence, etc., I think is key. And she's a good example of that, you know.
Yeah, I think we'll break it up with a song. I'm going to play a Charlie XCX song, and then we'll get back and we will talk a little bit about how gender is produced.
Absolutely fabulous.
Strawberries in the summer. Maybe your dad. Just kidding, I'm only saying that for effect.
Charlie XCX there with Wink Wink off of Music Fashion Film, released about 2 weeks ago now. Ever so slightly controversial album, but me personally, I love it. And I've been a fan of Charlie for a very, very long time. Post small technical difficulties, we are back. It is 10:21 a.m. and I am joined by Rosemary Overell. We were just talking about subcultures and emo and indie sleaze revival and the pop music industry. Now let's move on to gender and this idea of gender being a thing that is produced. Break it down for our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, I think this will be, familiar to some students who are doing a BA. But for all the listeners out there, I mean, we never want to take anything that's given as natural or what we call normal for granted, right? But the issue is when it comes down to our bodies, we often do take that for granted because what could be more natural than one's sort of fleshy body? So we could say up until potentially relatively recently, there was an idea that people are born one way or the other, either male or female, homosexual or heterosexual, right? It was just this sort of binarized line. But coming out of critical theory and then mainstreamed, this was a great mainstreaming of critical theory, we've had, I guess, approaches to gender which consider it more socially produced and performed even through the repetition of particular acts. So, for instance, I mean, I'm sort of breaking it quite down here, a woman might perform her womanhood through putting on makeup, wearing high heels and dresses and things like this. And it's not necessarily bound to a particular biological norm. But gender is always also socially produced even before we've had, you know, gender studies as a discipline.
Yeah.
So we can think back to how that works through media or even going even further back through books, right? So in the 19th and early 20th century, you had etiquette guides and guides for growing up for young women and men, right? Like ways to behave within the world. Of course, these are reinforced by institutions like the family, the church, I mean, church to the lesser extent now, but also commodity culture and the media. So presently, I think something like Married at First Sight or Love Island might help us work to what I would call orient our relation to gender. So I'm not saying we watch Love Island or MAFS and are sort of, what we say, slavishly copying the women and men on it.
Yeah.
But it might help us orient how we present ourselves as men or women, but also engage in, what we call the sexual relation. So whether that's between cis people or whatever, this idea of kind of rules around or norms around courtship, marriage, and how one should behave, right? These are kind of presented to us through an entertaining format, but might actually work to reinforce often heteronormativity or norms around feminine beauty and masculine, tough body culture and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's one example I would think of. I think fashion and popular media are good places where we can visibilise or materialise how gender is socially produced.
Yeah, and we can see the rise of that in trad wife culture,
oh my
right,
gosh.
Online.
Yeah.
And that, I don't know, as a young person, I can really only speak to my own experiences that there was a lot of freedom and there was the narrative that we were kind of going through intermediate and high school that you can be whatever, you can do whatever. The world is wide open now and there is a lot more freedom, a lot less restriction and a lot less personal oppression and internalized oppression. And then I went into university and they have that right-wing reaction to it. And we might think, young people, they're not dumb. They're exposing themselves to this media, but they can analyze it. But media happens so quickly when you're online. It is so fast. Your brain cannot digest it all. And you will internalize some of these ideas, even if you are a radical person, even if you are aware of that process.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, we always have these contradictions, which is kind of some of the work I did on metal, right?
Mm.
It was very misogynistic on a representational level. The lyrics are awful about cutting up women and things, but why was I enjoying it, even though I knew that it was misogynist? But to return to your point, the trad wife phenomenon, I mean, we could call it a backlash, right?
Yeah.
But also it fits more broadly into the stuff you were talking about around how women nowadays feel liberated through one can be anything within the marketplace, within the job market. You can have a seat at the CEO's table.
Yeah.
And in a way, the trad wife is simply a monetized or at least on social media, commodified form of housewifery.
Yeah.
Right? And I don't think that's liberating simply because she can turn her domestic labour into a money machine. I think this is just another form of capital encroaching on, the private realm, and this sort of unrelenting push, especially for youngsters or everybody today, to release their intimate lives to a public audience and turn it into a hustle.
Mm.
I'm the trad wife thing sort of, I guess, makes sense, but it's very troubling to me.
Yeah. 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 And anyone who's online, they're performing themselves for an audience. And people almost do that in real life now, which is the most concerning or just strange thing to me, that you can tell that everybody is thinking of themselves in a branded way. I remember my mum asking me, like, oh, you want to go traveling? Like, you know, you're an editor, you film things. Why don't you make it into a content thing? It was just like, because I want one part of my life to not be commodified. I want one part of my life to not be about making money.
I absolutely agree, and good on you. I mean, there is that imperative now to turn everything into content.
Mm.
And I think that idea of content always refers to something that can be traded on the market.
Yeah.
We need a more thoughtful approach to our lives in general and experiences like travel. I mean, it's sort of a cliche, but I do agree with it. If you're looking at it through the lens all the time and thinking, how am I going to edit this to engage an audience or suit the algo, you do lose something of the actual experience. And I was initiated by, shout out to James Downing, another one of our alumni who works in marketing, at the uni last week, he told me some influences to follow who are Otago students. So Savannah Bluden.
Yeah.
So I started following her. And of course, yeah, she's at the moment in Bali, I think, turning that into content. I mean, yeah, good luck to her. That's an enterprise. But the pressure on young people to have hustles is problematic. I mean, in terms of being a student, it would be great if folks could just engage with their classes, think deeply, have this sort of 3 or so years before they're forced to earn a salary to ask questions and be critical rather than that pressure of turning that into a kind of maxing, whether that's study maxing or lifestyle maxing on the side. So, yeah, I mean, I would celebrate anyone who's resisting that pressure to be enterprising in every single part of their life.
And bringing it back to that idea of performing and performing gender, if we take it back to it's that thing about nostalgia again, but a time where a person went to work and came home, and when they came home and that time was their own. And now I think we have this idea that the time that we have to ourselves is more time to make something, to hustle, to brand, to make money. And we are constantly performing. Even if we go work 40 hours a week at a job and we're performing gender, we're performing our identity in front of people there, we don't go home to behind doors, behind no audience and kind of release anymore. It's a constant 24/7 thing.
Yeah, and I think that is incredibly sad. And to me, this is the acceleration and intensification of what we might call late capitalism. So the old days, potentially, where people worked a 7-hour job, they'd go home, they'd relax, consume some mass media, and we could say, okay, that's a point in the day where their labour is reproduced through, they get to rest, they feed themselves so they can get up the next day and face the glumness of the 9-to-5.
Yeah.
But still, the 9-to-5 is where the value was largely extracted. But now you're right, 24/7, we're being hounded for, for some sort of extraction. Like even wellness influencers and stuff, they're telling you to maximise your off time. Even meditation, you could download an app and pay someone or turn yourself into a meditation influencer. You know, it's this kind of, it's unrelenting. And I think to go slow would be some kind of resistance, but it's almost impossible. You know,
well, it's what the Pope was talking about, right?
Yeah.
With cinema, and you need to protect slow cinema. You need to protect against the algorithm and protect against this desire for everything to be so quick and snappy.
Yeah, I agree. And I love the Pope speaking out against AI.
Yeah.
For the same reasons. I mean, what's the point of doing anything when you can just get the snappy response? Yeah, you get a snappy response, you know, commodified rebellion quickly summarized in 2 seconds by ChatGPT. But you're not actually going beyond the content, the surface level. You're not diving deep into what the politics of that might be, building a social bond and discussion about it. You're just kind of outsourcing the brain work or the depth work to a machine. And I think that's is an ethical issue, which I guess is why the Pope said it was unethical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And these are all topics that you can talk about if you study MIFCO at Otago University. I am a graduate of that program, and I recommend it. But I also recommend, you know, university, it's got walls, and if you want to access this information, it is out there. You can find it. It is all online. So if you're at all interested in any of these critical theory topics, dive into a little bit of your own research online. Thank you so much for joining me, Rosemary.
It's a pleasure, Lily. I'd be keen to come back another time.
Yes, of course.
Love the idea of a media meltdown.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little catharsis, right?
Thanks exactly. For people. Yeah.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcasts.